And Senator Hoffman, Senator Dyson, Senator Stedman, and Co-Chair Wilken, I'm Senator Green, and I welcome you all here today to continue the hearing on the PPT. And I'm glad to have Dan Dickinson and Sherry
Nienhuis.
Okay. I wrote it down. So, anyways, glad to have you here to continue where we stopped off yesterday. Now, Senator Wilken, did you have anything that you wish to announce before we begin? Okay, except that it's important that we finish in time for certain things, activities this afternoon. And it'll be ball. But anyway, go ahead and begin your presentation. We ended on yesterday, I believe, had finished page 7. Do you want to start on page 8 or do you want to back up a bit?
I will go ahead and just go through the slides real quickly and get us to where we're starting today.
Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Sherry Nienhuis. I'm a petroleum economist with the Department of Revenue. I also believe I have on the line with me Roger Marks, also a petroleum economist with the department. And if I can get a confirmation of that, that would be great. Roger is going to present the remainder. I'm going to go through the description of the model, a little bit about the cumulative revenues and the annual revenues, and then Roger will take up with the effective tax rate, state take, and quick inlet. So that's actually the overview right here. So continuing forward, Roger pretty much covered the progressive surcharge and how that works, the effect of those of the mechanisms in the Senate CS on the small companies and new investors. And he explained a little bit about the allowance. And so I'm going to pick up here on the volume scenarios. And as most of you know, when we talk about economic modeling, we're talking about making a lot of assumptions. And some of the assumptions we made regarding our PPT have to do with volume and costs and a couple other things, but I'll just start with volume and costs first of all. Our volume scenarios, we have two volume scenarios, and you'll hear us talk about low or high volume, and you'll also hear us talk about with or without gas line. So to explain the volume scenarios, briefly, the low volume scenario is pretty much as we have it in our spring 2006 revenue sources book. It follows the production that's included in there, and the three types of production that is included in that revenue sources book are oil under production currently, under development, and under evaluation, and it assumes no new discoveries. So that is basically the current production forecast. It includes about 5.7 billion barrels through 2030 when we expect, if there are no additional volumes to be found, that the taps will close down and the North Slope will no longer be operating. That is if there's no gas line and if there's no additional volumes. Our other volume scenario is what we call our enhanced volume scenarios, and we usually couple that with a gas line. And the reason is that if there is a gas line, we anticipate there will be additional exploration and there will be additional volumes found. So pretty much our enhanced volumes is the cumulative effect of the additional volumes, and it is also, there are also three effects on oil production that come from the gas line. That is a slight decline in the production of Prudhoe Bay. But however, we expect that Prudhoe Bay would have an extended field life and go through 2050. It would include an additional volumes of oil from the Point Thompson unit and additional oil associated with yet to find gas. And so our high volume scenario is about a little bit less than double our low volume scenario. It's about 10.5 billion barrels. Again, that's through 2050. And that does include an additional 1.7 billion barrels of heavy oil. But we do have a mechanism in our model that were the price to go below $30 a barrel, that the heavy oil would, there would be no additional heavy oil because heavy oil is quite expensive to produce. Okay, and so moving on, here's a graph of our volume scenarios. The blue line is the low volume scenario, and that only goes through 2030. And then the wavy pink line is our high volume scenario. And what the waves indicate are the addition of the enhanced volumes coming online every 5 years or so. And now a little bit about our costs and prices. We did have to make some cost assumptions in our modeling. We believe they're fairly accurate. They're based on public and non-public sources, so that it would include partnership returns and various other tax information. And to break it down, we have several different types of costs. So we haven't just said there's one cost per barrel of oil. There are several different types of costs. There is the exploration cost, and that goes through 2040, and that's about $100 million a year. We have three different types of capital costs. We have ongoing capital, which is a dollar per barrel on all the barrels. We have developmental capital, which is $3.50 on what we call existing conventional oil, conventional as opposed to heavy oil, and $8 per barrel on developmental capital of two-thirds of the existing heavy oil. And then we also have various prices or costs associated with new conventional and new heavy oil. Those are about the same as the existing. And then the operating costs, we have $3 per barrel on conventional oil and $5 per barrel operating costs on heavy oil. And these costs have not been inflated. They're on today's dollars, 2005 dollars. Heavy oil, we've discounted 8%. The price, we've discounted 8% for quality. And then finally, we did have to do some special modeling for the provisions in the Senate Resources CS. The 5,000 barrel per day allowance, what we did was we assumed current rates or companies that have 5,000 barrels or less and determined that about 2.5% of the oil would be subject to this 5,000 barrel per day provision. And that would ramp up each year because, as you know, with declining volumes, you would have additional oil that was being produced by a small producer, and that producer might be sliding into the 5,000 barrel per day range with smaller production. And finally, on the transition expenditures, basically the Senate Resources CS allows 70% of the transition expenditures as a two-for-one at a 20% credit. So we estimated that to be $100 million per year over 7 years. Now, to be clear, with the PPT, you're not just subject to price risk and production risk, but you're also subject to cost risk. So it's important to note that on each of these costs, if we are off by a dollar, above or below, that would affect our revenues about $70 million. Per year. Okay. I believe Roger in previous testimony said $200 million, that would be if we were off on three different costs at that amount. Okay. So it's each piece of this puzzle, if we were off a dollar, it would affect our revenues approximately $70 million per year.
Senator Wilkin has a question.
So did you just say that under costs, any of those that say per barrel, if you're off by a dollar on any of those, it's a $70 million effect?
That's correct.
Okay, per barrel. Thank you.
Okay, and then moving on. What we did not model, as we know, there are a number of these mechanisms, that would probably affect production, probably affect future exploration and result in production. And some of these are that with incentives, you would have theoretically more investment, and more investment would mean more production. The credits are also an incentive, so those would theoretically lead to more production. You'd expect more investment with higher prices, and conversely, you might expect less investment with higher taxes. And finally, we all know that investment is driven by international opportunities, and so the way the world is changing, the fiscal systems of the global petroleum market are changing, and that could also affect the way Alaska's production proceeds. We did not model them at all, and the reason is that we wanted to keep the results of our modeling purely a tax effect. Any of these additions to our model, these feedback effects, could be subject to debate and possibly result in modeling error. So we decided to try and leave those things out, and we've done that. The one mechanism I told you about that we did have relative to price is that we decreased our heavy oil volumes, and we believe that there's a good reason for that. Heavy oil is very expensive to produce. Okay, so moving along then, I'd like to talk a little bit about cumulative revenues, because we believe that cumulative revenues is probably the most important point in all this presentation on revenue. Cumulative revenues would show, for example, with the what we call the low volume scenario, and we generally provide that without the gas line, because we believe that if the gas line were online, we'd have additional revenues, or excuse me, additional production, so additional volumes. So at the low volume scenario, you'll have revenues through 2030. With a high volume scenario with the gas line, we have revenues through 2050. An important distinction between the high volume volumes with gas line and the low volume scenario without the gas line is that the high volume scenario includes the gas line cost. So in other words, it does not include the pipeline itself, but it includes the upstream costs, the costs for the gas processing plant and various other costs to develop the gas. So in the high volume scenario with a gas line, we're going to have additional costs, but we won't be showing those revenues. And the reason is that the revenues associated with the gas line will be part of the gas line contract and are not part of this PPT. So in effect, I guess mentally, I have to think, okay, we have higher costs, but really we'd also expect to have higher revenues, but they just are not shown here. So, and again, I guess I'd encourage the members to look at cumulative long-term revenues. The way we modeled this is that since we could not forecast when capital costs would be, capital expenditures would occur, we smoothed them over the life of the project to show a long-term effect. When you take any snapshot of a year, especially a year that's farther out, 2030, 2020, I can guarantee you our costs are wrong. We don't know in any one year if that is the correct amount. We do know over long term what the trends are in spending, what we expect the trends to be in spending, what they expect the trends to be in revenue. So I do want to encourage you to always look at the long term. So moving on to the next slide. We have the low volume scenario. That would be the revenues from 2006 through 2030. And I want to direct your attention to the scale over there. Those are cumulative severance tax amounts in billions of dollars. And you see that the crossover point for the Senate CS here is 2160. And the governor's bill, the crossover point is 2770. And in the Senate Resources CS, you see that there's a slight bend upwards at $40, and that reflects the progressivity mechanism. And then going on to the high volume scenario, again, you're going to have a higher crossover point, and that is because of increased costs, and also the heavy oil kicks in. We have several heavy oil additional volumes, and those are more costly to produce. So the crossover point here is 2560 for the Senate Resources CS and 3420 for the governor's. And the scale on the left-hand side there is quite a bit higher, so you want to take note of that. And this is also a longer time frame. There's additional oil shown here, and so that's another thing to note.
Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in reference to this chart, I'm trying to understand that. So across the bottom, price per barrel, and cumulative severance tax up the y-axis. So let's see, status quo, let's just take the Senate CS. So at $45 a barrel, the cumulative over those years is $50 billion. That's how we read that.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, that's correct.
And the governor's bill and status quo. Okay. Are you able to lay the House CS on there, on that number?
Through the chair, we could, if you'd like. I can't do it right now, but I could do it and provide it to you.
And that's $50 billion or over 44 years.
That is correct. Of course, remember that the governor's bill does not take effect till 2007, so you have the couple month difference.
Senator Stedman.
We can work on that effective date a little bit if we need to. But anyway, a couple points. I'd like to have a little bit of discussion on the discounting, real versus nominal dollars, how you guys are handling that in time, because clearly, you know, when we start forecasting a year out, it's very difficult, and 30 or 40 years out is near impossible. And also, you know, if we come back and we do these charts for comparison, I think it would be nice if we held the Y scale constant so we can flip back and forth here. We've got a low volume scenario. The next page is a high volume scenario, but with the Y axis changing in scale, it makes it more difficult, you know, to compare the two. But I would like to have some more information on how they're handling the time value of money and if they feel their modeling is substantially different than Econ 1's. There's going to be some differences, but.
Through the chair, Senator Stebbins, I believe we began our first presentation, or several of our early presentations showed an inflated dollar. I think we were using 2%. I think, and I'll let Mr. Marks jump in here and add something to this, but I think the decision was made to take those effects out because we found that they really magnified things quite a bit and possibly beyond what we really should be expecting. I think it looked like very much higher revenues than I think what we understand them to be at this point. And Mr. Marks, would you like to also add something to that?
On discounting rather than inflating. On discount, we have not run discounted numbers. It would not be difficult to do. Certainly discounting would reduce all the numbers, but in terms of the relative effects of the different proposals with each other, I don't think you'd see much of a difference if you did discount, but we could certainly do that.
Roger, do you want to identify yourself for...
This is Roger Marks, petroleum economist with the Department of Revenue.
Thanks. Senator Stedman.
Madam Chair, just one of the difficulties we have when we're dealing with the administration and we have multiple consultants ourselves, we've got some data that's 07 to 16, 07 to 30. We've got nominal, we've got real. And when we start going back and forth in our presentations and stuff like that, it would be nice, just as a footnote on the data that what we're actually looking at, if it's nominal or real. And I'm not asking to have them go back and redo it in real terms. Just so it's clear what we're looking at.
Yep, Madam Chairman, this is Roger Marks again. These numbers are real 2005 dollars, and as Ms. Nienhuis said, we originally presented these way back in early February to both your committee and House Finance with nominal numbers, with inflation, and upon reflection, it occurred to us that much of what we saw was simply due to inflation. And so we, with our judgment, that a more accurate picture would be to just take inflation out. On the issue of Econ 1, we've actually consulted quite a bit with Econ 1 back and forth, and our modeling results are quite similar. I think when we looked at the governor's bill, I think our crossover points, for instance, were within pennies.
Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Senator Stedman was kind of getting at my question. The dollars across the x-axis here are real dollars. And for me, and maybe people are listening, would you explain what's the difference between real and nominal dollars?
Yes, Senator Dyson, through the chair. Real dollars would be, basically in these terms, would be today's dollars as opposed to...
What dollars?
Today's dollars, as opposed to dollars that are inflated over time, which would be something that would happen.
So nominal means an inflation factor put into it.
Senator Dyson, through the chair, I mean, as I like to think of these are in purchasing power dollars. So this is what gets you $55 worth of goods today, and 10 years down the road, it'll still get you $55 worth. And if inflation's been huge, you might have actually plunked down a $100 bill to get $55 worth. But this sort of represents your real purchasing power. And what it doesn't reflect is the fact if everything sort of moves up together, the costs, you will have to shell out more pieces of paper to get that same purchasing power. So they're real. You're correct. They're real. They do not have an inflation built in. The nominal dollar would say what would actually the number on a check be, which would have a inflation component built into it. And I think the point that Mr. Marx is making is that when you do a 50-year projection and you put in a 2% growth every year or something, most of the dollars that you're seeing isn't a comparison between plans. It's simply, as Einstein said, that the compounding power is the most powerful force in the universe, and you just 2% for 50 years is a huge amount gets added. And when people look at it, they may think of that as representing more purchasing power than it really does, because most of it isn't an increase in purchasing power, it's just inflation at work.
That answer your question?
I think so.
Well, we're in the process of kind of making a list of things for which we want a glossary, and we'll include real dollar and nominal dollar. And if any of you think of anything else you want in your glossary, let me know and we'll include it. Senator Dyson.
And I think that isn't real dollars the same as dollars of the day? Another term of art.
I'll let Roger jump. I mean, dollars of the day are typically going to be the nominal amount. In other words, what you will see in that time period.
All right. So dollars of the day is nominal then.
Yeah, money of the day is nominal.
Yeah.
And real, it's the dollars that you see today.
Yes. Right, and that's the difference when I'm saying they're today's dollars as opposed to 2010 dollars.
And then the discount factor you're using to move the money in time.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, the discount factor goes the other way. You take what you typically will do is you'll take a stream of payments, and then you'll say, what does that represent if I had all those dollars today? And so it's discounting. It's removing them all into today. So if you've inflated going out, and then you discount it back down to today's dollars, and a great deal of mischief can occur if you inflate at one rate and discount at a different rate. But Madam Chair, if I might, just for Senator Wilkins' earlier question, we in fact do have here in paper a presentation made to the House, which has the House committee. Now, if you'd rather wait till we get it all copied or get it to you electronically, perhaps, but if the Senator would like to see these or have them photocopied, we could answer questions on the House CS.
Is Rose here? Yeah, we'll have Rose come pick them up and then she can get them copied for us. Thank you. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just perhaps a suggestion on formatting. It would help me when I look at a chart like that if we had just some minimal XY grid lines. I know this isn't exact science, but it would help show the difference on any particular axis between the lines. Formatting. Thank you.
It's one of the options in Excel, Senator, if we can.
Okay, if there are no further questions, I'll go ahead and move on.
Madam Chair, and
Senator Hoffman.
And if we can get the figure 4 and 5 with progressivity at different levels on the governor's bill at 0.2, 0.25, 0.3.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, the governor's bill doesn't have the progress.
I know, but if,
you would
if
like
it did.
Added?
Right.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, make sure I get this. So you would take the
progressivity
factor in the Senate CS from the resources
and at
CS,
different levels, you know,
and
they
then
have
instead of 0.2, you would do it at
0.2, 0.3.
Yeah. Is that clear?
Okay, is that clear? Okay,
I believe so. Thank
you. Go ahead.
Okay, and then moving on to annual revenues. Again, we show the same scenarios, the same volume scenarios. One, the low volume scenario without enhanced volumes, without the gas line through 2030, and with the gas line with enhanced volumes through 2050. And again, this does not include the gas line severance taxes, but it does include the gas line costs in the second version, in the high volume version. Okay, figure six. This again, this is at a fairly low price, $20 per barrel. And you see that the status quo is goes up about like what you expect. It's not sensitive to price at all. It's fairly high with current production rates, and it declines with production. The Senate CS has a couple lumps in it, and I can explain a couple of those. The second upward lump basically is a decrease in the TAPS tariff. We're not exactly sure what's going to happen with the TAPS tariff, but we do believe that it will be negotiated again and could be slightly reduced over time. So that reflects that bump on the graph. And then around 2013, 2014, there's a dip and then it goes up again. This is in the Senate CS. That is basically the end of the allowance provision and the transition provision. But again, these are fairly graphic at $20 prices because the costs and the taxes have a significant effect at those prices.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Stedman.
There's been testimony in the past from at least one, if not more, of the major producers saying that they're going to go broke at $20 a barrel. Will they be in existence in 2020 or 2015 at $20 a barrel, in your opinion? BP is an example. I think their break even is a little over 20.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I don't think their characterization was they'd go broke. I think their characterization was they were not making sufficient money to reinvest at those rates. And I think clearly at those kind of prices, they would not be making significant reinvestments.
And if I could, Madam Chair, at $20 a barrel, what financial position would the state be in?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, a terrible one.
I guess the point of the question, Madam Chair, I think at $20 a barrel,
we'd be broke.
We'd have a lot of things to be concerned about, and the severance tax probably wouldn't make even the first page.
It would be one of many things.
You're one of many things.
Our replacements to be dealing with it. Could it be one of these? Blah, 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 blah.
Yep. And if I could, Madam Chair, just one more comment.
Go ahead.
I have a hard time personally accepting those numbers that have been presented by some of the producers at 20, a little over $20 a barrel is their break-even point. They're using some capital cost infusions every year, and it's not really, in my opinion, their break-even. And we'll deal with that later on down the line, but I guess we can have different definitions of break-even, and I think their definition is fairly liberal.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I might maybe just point out that the handout that you've just gotten is in fact the response to Senator Wilkins' earlier request. I know what's probably frustrating is what you'd like to see is have them plotted on the same piece, same document, which is what I meant by getting it to you electronically. but I don't know if Should we just wait till we do that and get that to you in that format, or?
That'd be great. Okay.
If you would, please.
Did you want House and Senate on one?
Yeah, just
along
on,
with Governor and status quo?
Slide number 13 and,
okay.
13 and 14, if we could just add another category of House CS.
Mm-hmm. And have the y-axis consistent.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stedman.
I think, and maybe later on in the presentation, I think we come into that, but while we're on the subject, I think when we ask them to redo these slides, it would be nice to have one set with a severance tax and another set with total government take, so we can see the whole pie. Totally. Otherwise, we're looking at only part of what we're working with.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I might, this presentation in earlier form ran to well over 2 hours. A number of slides have been cut. We can certainly bring this to you. In fact, some of this was in an earlier version, so I just want to make sure that you understand we weren't trying to hide anything. We just thought to...
No, you're... Yeah.
Fair enough.
You're fine. These may go on for days. But we're flexible, and we hope you can, you too. Now we're on six, okay.
If there are no further questions, I'll go ahead and move on to figure seven. This is the same volume scenario at $40 per barrel. Just something to draw your attention to at the bottom of the slide, it says the Senate CS has average annual revenues of $600 million more than the status quo and $300 million more than the governor's bill. That is average annual revenues. At any given point in time, it could be different than that, but that's average over the 24-year period, 25-year with the Senate CS. And you can see that the bumps in the graph become less pronounced, and that is because of the higher oil price. And figure eight shows the same volume scenario at $60 per barrel. And again,
excuse me.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. You just said that on figure seven that the Senate CS is $600 million average more than the governor's bill.
No, that would be than the status quo.
Oh, I see. And the governor's would be how much more?
Through the chair, that would be $300 million more. The Senate CS has $300 million more than the governor's bill on average.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm.
And on the $60 per barrel, and to draw your attention to the y-axis, that is quite a bit higher than the one previously shown. The important fact, I think, to take away from this slide is that the Senate CS has average annual revenues of $1.6 billion more than the status quo and $800 million more than the governor's bill. And the progressive surcharge at this price adds $40 to $60, adds $200 to $400 million more. And this is a note from Roger. I'm not that knowledgeable about the gas situation, but he says at the bottom that the $1.6 billion is about the equivalent to the state gas line revenues at $6 per million BTU of Chicago price.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Could we have that last comment repeated? I may have a question.
Yes, Senator Stedman, through the chair. That's the very last line on the page with a graph. Note, this is equivalent, and I clarified with Roger that he's talking about, the $1.6 billion. This $1.6 billion is equivalent to the state gas line revenues at $6 per million BTU Chicago price without the gas line.
Madam Chairman, this is Roger Mark. It's just sort of an interesting observation that at current prices under the Senate CS, you get your gas line revenues without the gas line at a, you know, equivalent to a Chicago price of $6 per million BTU. That's simply an observation that some people find interesting.
Good. I find it interesting. Yes, Senator Hoffman.
And what is today's gas price?
About $7, a little over $7.
Yeah, I think we should just note that this is an integral piece of this whole gas line puzzle, and the revenues we're talking about here are substantial in comparison to the gas line. So this is not a minor revenue stream relative to what's coming in the gas line. Let me rephrase that.
I think
some people in the public feel that the revenue stream coming to the state after the construction of the gas line is the key to the future, which I don't necessarily disagree with, but this is a huge, what we're dealing with today is a huge piece of the revenue stream, and we should not minimize that as we work on this, because there is the possibility, although hopefully it won't happen, that we don't have a gas line.
Thank you.
Okay, and continuing on to our figure 9, this shows the same values, the same oil prices with a high volume scenario with a gas line. It's important to note that there's a fairly large dip in the Senate CS line at about 2010, and it goes to about 2013. That reflects the cost to develop Point Thompson. We expect Point Thompson development to occur in that time period, and that's why you see that the costs are included, and therefore the severance tax goes down to zero, if not very close to zero. And the...
That's Senator Stedman.
Just another comment. When we work on these low price scenarios, we still have royalties, property tax, and if there is any corporate income tax, probably be minimal. I would expect if we were in that scenario, not only would the state be on the ropes, but the industry would be coming in wanting some some breaks on their other tax. So it's just got to remember some of those dynamic issues when we look at this $20 price.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, if I might just amplify on that comment. Another point, and I think you folks here have observed that because the left-hand axis changes so much, maybe you're not getting a sense of this, but one of the figures that I think you'll hear from Roger occasionally on a lot of these scenarios is we can have 1 year at the higher price, and we will generate enough to cover the difference of, say, 4 years at the lower price. In other words, if you look at this scale, it's $300 million. And so someone could look at this and say, gee, while Point Thompson is being developed, we get zero severance tax under the CS. But what you're seeing there is, under the status quo, we'd only be picking up $200 million in severance taxes a year. Mm-hmm. In other words, by looking at the scale, the blue line's at 200 during that period where Point Thompson's being built, and the Senate CS is at zero. That's $200 million. If you flip ahead, say, two pages to figure 11, and you'll see if those same years or high years, the Senate CS will be picking up over $1 billion more than the status quo. And so in that particular case, it'd almost be a six to one or seven to one. You know, 7 years of low price would be recovered with 1 year of high price. And so again, I think clearly if we have prolonged periods of low price, that's one thing, but I think what we need to do is focus on the fact that it's not an even offset. It's not 1 year of high prices puts us above, 1 year of low prices puts us below. Mm-hmm. I think you've correctly observed that the not having this, having the scales change may be somewhat obscuring that fact visually. Sorry, I didn't mean to take you back to page 9, or figure 9 there.
Okay. And moving on to figure 10 then, and just harking back to what Mr. Dickinson said, the scale is quite a bit higher here. We'll work on getting our scaling correct. But again, you're seeing some of the gas costs in between 2010 and 2013, but then around 2015, we start seeing revenues from the Point Thompson unit, and those would be oil revenues, of course, and not gas. And somewhere around 2030, 31, 32 is when we have the cost for the yet-to-find gas fields. These are then included in this whole volume scenario. And so you see a lot of squiggly lines, but that basically means costs, revenues, kind of that's sort of the way it occurs. And if there's no further questions, I'll go on to figure 11. The same scenario at $60 per barrel. And again, drawing your attention to the lines at the bottom of your slide of the slide here in your piece of paper, Senate CS has average annual revenues of $1.5 billion more than the status quo and $800 million more than the governor's bill. And typically, the progressive surcharges add about $200 to $400 million. Okay, if there's no further questions, I'll go on to the effective tax rate. We were asked by several members of the Resources Committees to put together something that we could compare to the status quo. As you know, the status quo taxes on basically gross revenues minus royalty. Some people refer to it as the gross profit value at the point of production. That's our new term of art, I guess. Anyway, basically, that taxes the gross as opposed to taxing the net, which is what we would do under the PPT. So in order to provide a comparison for you, we came up with what we call the effective tax rate. Now, you'll hear that term also be used in different contexts, so you do need to be careful when you hear that term, but we do have it defined for you here. Basically, it's the severance tax as a function of the wellhead less royalty. Okay, so the value of the oil at the wellhead, basically, after we take out the royalty, because that is the point where we start taxing. So we have a situation with the enhanced volumes without the gas line. I'm sorry, without enhanced volumes and without the gas line, and with enhanced volumes and with the gas line. So moving on to Figure 12, we show the effective severance tax rate at different prices. You can see that the status quo is a flat, just about 5%. It's not sensitive to price, so you'll see it stays flat all the way across the price range. The governor's bill is progressive with price. You can see it's the next line up. And finally, the Senate CS is also progressive with price. And the Senate CS again crosses over the status quo line at about $21.60 and the governor's bill at about $27.70.
Madam Chair, if I can just clarify that, because that if you look in the governor's bill, it says 20%. And what this is, but that's 20% of the net. What this graph is doing is showing you gross. In other words, the same base that the ELF is currently on. So we're getting an apples to apples comparison between the purple line, the two purple lines, the status quo line and the governor's bill and then the Senate CS. So this is saying an effective tax rate based on the same measure, and that's why it is progressive in that respect.
Senator Stedman.
One of the things that we talked about at the previous committee numerous times was the issue of the benchmark error. Come back again and again, and we talk about the existing status quo, the ELF system. I think pretty much everybody would agree that it's broken, except for possibly the people that are paying the bill. And that, it's not, in my opinion, the proper benchmark, because it's dysfunctional at this time. And it's nice to have on here as a reference point, but it has limited value. And if I could just add a couple other things, because it's, and I'm not being critical of the charts, but it'd be nice if we could, you know, we've got our dollars, if we could, in Excel, you can put more, you know, you can have the $30, the $40, and you can label the little dot data points. Because what's nice for us to do is to be able to go back into the Econ 1 data and the other data we have and look for large discrepancies, which would tip us off that we may have a data error or something's going on. And as long as everything's kind of within a reasonable range, it's hard. You know, we've got the, like here, we've got the yellow line, the Senate CS, but it would be nice to have the little data point, at least a few of the little data point numbers so we can, you know, reference back. Because at least I'm constantly going back and checking with our other presenters to make sure everybody's kind of in agreement within a range, because it's all estimates and guesstimates.
Are you talking about having a grid plus having additional dollar variances?
No, I'm talking about when they reformat the charts to put some data labels on them. And here they've got, they're doing $10 increments on the fives.
Right.
Most of Econ 1's work was dollar increments on the 10 or $10 increments. It makes it easier for us to line up and look for errors.
You mean it was at 10, 20, 30? Versus 5, 15, 25, 35.
Right, and there's no numbers on the chart, so we can't go back and look and compare. And
oh, you just have to estimate.
Right, because we're working with these estimates that go out and expectations that go out for decades, and we're just looking for a reasonable tight range between the different presenters in case there is an error. That's the only way it's going to show up.
Senator Hoffman.
But this does show that at $45, the governor's bill increases the tax by 100%.
From now.
And not enough. And we'll get into that later.
My goodness.
From status quo. Right. Well, we'll work on that later, Madam Chair.
Continue, please.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, we could certainly add some data points for you, and that's no problem. Okay, and then moving on to figure 13. This would be under the high volume scenario. I think you'll, if you compare it to figure 12, the same point, I'm trying to think, was it $40 we were looking at? Is slightly lower on the governor's bill and on the Senate CS because it does include the costs of the gas line in here and also the heavy oil costs. But we will certainly go ahead and put some data points on here if that makes it easier, and that way you can do some direct comparisons.
Thank you. Senator Stedman.
The cost of the gas line, what numbers are you using? 25 billion, 30 billion.
Senator Stedman, if I might correct that slightly, these would be the upstream costs to develop the project, which would be deductible under the PPT. In other words, when investments are made in Prudhoe Bay, it's very hard to distinguish between oil and gas. The same thing when so just to correct that, the actual costs of the gas line are not what is being deducted or caused the difference. It's ancillary costs upstream. I believe it's, and so the cost to develop Point Thompson, I believe, are in the three, maybe Roger Marks can correct me, I think it's about $3 billion, and I think their incremental costs in Prudhoe Bay is on the order of several hundred million.
And this bill has a 20% credit in it. I'll just ask you that in private. I got a question on how you're dealing with some of that stuff.
Friend.
Go ahead.
Okay, and I believe Roger Marks is going to take over at this point.
Okay.
So, Roger.
Okay. This is Roger Marks, Department of Revenue. Our next set of slides show what state take would be under the high and low volume scenarios. Slide 26, which is figure 14, shows state take under the low volume scenario. And what do we mean by state take? This is how much money the total amount of state revenues, the royalties, severance tax, property tax, and corporate income tax, divided by what we call the economic rent, which is pre-tax profits. The way to think of what economic rent is, that's generally how people think about when they think about take is as a percent of the economic rent. So figure 14 under the low volume scenario, what it shows at low prices, we're still talking a regressive system at low prices. And what we mean by regressive is when prices are low, the state take is high. And why is this? There are basically three reasons. One, our property tax is based on assessed value. It's based on cost. Has nothing to do with price. And so it is what it is, whether prices are $15 or $65. Our state corporate income tax is based on worldwide apportionment and profits of the oil companies worldwide. Much of those depend not only on oil prices, certainly they do, but they also depend on their refinery margins. An integrated producer is quite hedged in that they make a lot of money on the refining arm of their business when oil prices are low. And so the modeling we've done shows a significant correlation between our corporate income taxes and refinery margins. And so at low prices, our corporate income taxes are elevated because of that. And finally, the royalties, again, are based on the gross value of the point of production, do not reflect the upstream costs. So that is why under all three proposals, the state still gets a high share of the rent at low prices. As you kind of come around the bend at around $25 or so, what emerges is that under the status quo, our state take decreases as prices go up. In the governor's bill, it's fairly level, and under the Senate CS, it increases slightly, mainly because of the progressivity surcharge. And figure 15 basically shows the same story under the high volume scenario. The results are not materially different. Now there's an additional slide that was handed out this morning, is that right? Figure 16. You all have that?
There's no figure on it.
I don't think it's in the slideshow, but I believe that was handed out. Is that right, Sherry?
Yeah, it's this one.
Yes, I believe so.
Okay. Figure 16, there was an oral request yesterday that we also include total government take. And so this is something we put together this morning. It shows what happens, total government take, the difference between 2520 and 2020, with all other provisions of the Senate CS the same. And as an example, we just ran this under the low volume scenario. Under the high volume scenario, again, the results would be the same. The difference in the 5% tax rate comes down to about a 3.75% difference in total government take. The reason a 5% change in tax rate causes a 3.75% change in total government take is because the federal the severance tax is deductible for federal corporate income tax. So actually, the feds on an after-tax basis pick up the tab on 35% of the severance tax. In addition, there's also a slight decrease in because the severance tax is also deductible for state corporate income taxes. There's also a slight accounting for that. So the 3.75%, about 90% of that is the federal effect, and about 10% is on the state effect.
Senator Stedman.
I think we got slide 16, that must be state take, state government take, or not
total government. It must be state take.
It's got to be state take. That, there's an error in there. Because a federal take.
You know what?
The total take's got to be up around 60% when we factor in federal government.
That's correct. It's like the wrong numbers got pulled into there. Let me get you those.
That has to be total state take.
Total state take.
Yeah, so Madam Chair, if we could, maybe we could have these charts, I think there are 14 and 15 and 16, add a few more with the federal government in there, because we've got a lot of data that has total government take, and then it doesn't differentiate out state versus federal. It's not quite 50-50 split there, but...
Do you want it on one chart, or do you also want to show federal take?
I'd like one with not federal isolated, but one with federal included.
Okay.
So when we look at the industry at $60 or $50 oil or $40 oil, we know what percent of take is going to the industry, what percent are the producers, what percent of the take is going to the government side, and then we can split up the government side by state and federal.
Yeah, what we do, though, I guess what happens when you do things at the last minute. I apologize for that.
That's okay.
Yeah, the total government take would be around 60%.
Right.
With about a 3% reduction, that 3% difference, whether it's 25-20 or 20-20.
Mm-hmm. And if I could, Madam Chair, I think one of the points just for the public as they follow this, a lot of times there's a concern that the state take, you know, we're not getting our fair share, but we got to remember that there's the state, the federal government, and the producers.
Right.
And we all get a cut, and we got to look at the whole pie.
That's true.
Senator Wilkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Roger, just for the record, if the x-axis went all the way out to 120 or 150, those lines would stay essentially flat. There wouldn't be any changes beyond 65.
Well, no, with under the Senate CS, with the progressivity element, they would increase slightly. As you know, if you kind of look at the slope there, it's going up slightly, and that would continue because of the surcharge.
The lines would continue on the slope that we see.
Right. They would still slope. The distance between the lines would stay constant.
Yes.
Pretty much, but they would increase slightly.
It would just be a gentle rise out as far as you wanted to price barrel dollars per barrel.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
And welcome, Senator Bundy.
So finally, I get to conclude the presentation. We want to talk a little bit about what happens to Cook Inlet under the PPT proposal.
Okay.
And I'm on looking at slide 29, which is a table showing Cook Inlet oil and gas production. What this shows is Cook Inlet is mostly a gas province. On a barrel of oil equivalent, it's about 80% gas, about 20% oil. The gas is about 200 BCF a year. That's split between providing space heat, power generation, the LNG plant, and the agrium ammonia urea plant. Slide 30, again, just some observations about Cook Inlet gas that kind of suggests what the result of PPT might be on it. Again, it's about 80% gas. We expect the impact on oil taxes to be not significant because the cost of producing oil in Cook Inlet are fairly high. Those fields are mostly depleted out. There may be some additional taxes if oil prices were very high. But on the gas front, the Cook Inlet gas industry is evolving, and where it's evolving is difficult to say. There are lots of different forces at play here. For the most part, most of the production comes from fairly old fields. Production is decreasing. Most of the capital on these fields have been recovered. There may be some increased investment on Cook Inlet. Fruit will bear remains to be seen. On the price front, for the last 40 years since Cook Inlet gas came on, it was a fairly the market was it was a closed market. There were a few sets of buyers and a few sets of sellers, and that set the market dynamics. Prices were fairly low, but no one really had options outside the system. Quite a kind of a revolutionary turn of events in the last couple of years. The RCA has awarded to Unocal in their sales to NSTAR the ability to use Henry Hub prices, that's Gulf of Mexico prices, as a way at the price where NSTAR is buying gas from Unocal. What that suggests is a leakage inside, from outside the system in, at least institutionally in terms of that pricing. It is a closed system. Those prices are high. They're up before then. The current contracts in Cook Inlet that are not subject to that provision are in sort of the mid $2 levels. But for those of us who pay gas bills in Anchorage, now understand that with tying it to Henry Hub, prices can be quite high. And whether this trend will continue remains to be seen. Marathon has asked the RCA for a similar deal in their sales to Unocal, and the RCA is considering that. So quite a lot of uncertainty about what the price picture in Cook Inlet is. In addition, it's unclear whether the LNG plant is going to have its export permit reissued by Department of Energy in 2009. That could very well shut down. It's unclear whether the Agrium plant can continue to operate with higher prices. And then with the specter of North Slope gas coming on and North Slope gas entering Cook Inlet, it may be throwing the brakes on some investment decisions in Cook Inlet. So hard to say exactly where Cook Inlet is going. It's fairly complicated. As a result of the PPT on the existing fields, we do at higher prices, we would expect taxes to go up. New fields, insofar as they can deduct costs and claim credits, their taxes may go down. In addition, as we talked about yesterday, because the provisions to attract new and small investors, net present value of investments for Cook Inlet development may go up. Now when we say taxes may go up in Cook Inlet, go up in relation to what? If you flip over to slide 31, the current Cook Inlet severance taxes are subject to the gas elf. There's been a lot of discussion about the oil elf. Well, the state also has a gas elf. It applies in Cook Inlet as well as the North Slope, although there's a very, very small amount of gas that's subject to severance taxes on the North Slope right now. The gas elf operates more simply than the oil elf. The gas elf simply gives a producer 3,000 MCF per well per day tax-free. And so as an example, if you produce 10,000 MCF per well per day, your ELF would be 0.7, or if you produce 6,000, your ELF would be 0.5. Your first 3,000 is tax-free, and the rest is subject to a nominal gas severance tax of 10%. The gas ELF was instituted in 1977. It has not changed since then. In terms of fiscal stability, the gas severance tax has been in place for 30 years now. The gas elf was, like the oil elf, predicated on the principle that a producer should be able to recover his operating costs based on the price of gas and the operating costs, so the tax itself doesn't make the field shut down. In 1977, the price of gas was 65 cents. So certainly, you know, the economics of gas in Cook Inlet is quite a bit different now, but the current ELF in place reflects the economics 30 years ago. And so, you know, as the oil ELF is broken, at least as far as Cook Inlet is concerned, we believe the gas ELF is broken as well. And so if taxes go up there as a result of PPT, you know, we think that's appropriate if prices are high enough. Slide 32 just shows a...
Roger?
Yes, ma'am.
Excuse me. Senator Bundy has a question.
Sure.
Thank you. You had said on an earlier slide that the PPT tax in Cook Inlet would be insignificant.
On oil.
On oil, yes. And had some folks in the other day from Chevron who felt that this was going to be very significant. Can you address why they might think that this would make their the older Cook Inlet wells uneconomical?
Well, certainly Cook Inlet oil. The production is very low. The oil production. They're not getting a lot of bang for the buck right now on their wells. There's not a lot of new capital investment going on, so they certainly couldn't deduct a lot of capital costs and claim a lot of credits. Their operating costs are pretty high. Maybe around $15 a barrel, so they could certainly deduct those. If you could flip back to slide 29, the chart there, if you take the 5,000 barrel a day allowance into effect, what shows up there is that certainly, you know, all the fields except Forest Oil might have, you know, most of their oil is going to be covered under the 5,000 barrel a day allowance. Chevron Unocal's issue is that they're also going to have a lot of North Slope production that's going to be combined, and you know, this is a company-wide tax. If it were just isolated by itself, the 5,000 barrel a day allowance would probably cover Chevron Unocal, but as they probably realize, is that with their North Slope production, that allowance is not going to be very effective in Cook Inlet.
Yep.
Go ahead.
I would say at current prices, you know, their oil taxes would be higher, and I would agree with them. I have not, you know, we're kind of reluctant to publicly talk about company specific data and outcomes here, and so we haven't really calculated that crossover point for Chevron Unocal. But certainly if anyone's taxes would go up for oil in Cook Inlet, it would be them. And that's attributable to large extent that the small company allowance is sort of negated by their North Slope production. So I would not disagree with what they said. But there is a crossover point where their taxes would go up, where that is. We haven't looked at it.
Thank you.
Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Roger, kind of a follow-on to Senator Bundy's question. A couple years ago, we tried to do some things to incent more exploration production in Cook Inlet. And at least a couple of the Cook Inlet active oil companies said that we got it wrong in that we only allowed a deduction for exploration that was successful. And so they said, you know, that doesn't give us an incentive to go out looking at areas that were real wildcats, and that we should have given the incentive for exploration wells, whether they're successful or not. Just generally, would you comment on that? And are they right?
Yes, they are. Both most exploration, comes up of a failure. So any tax benefits or any provisions that you must have production for to capitalize on is worth nothing if you don't have any production. Now those same people should love the PPT. Again, we talked yesterday about the ability, the provisions that were made to help small producers and new producers. The fact that we took an example of a pure wildcatter that would come in, and if he explores and spends $10 million for an exploration well, if he comes up dry under the current system, the state shares none of his costs, zero. Under the PPT, number one, if he spends $10 million, he's going to have a $10 million loss. He can convert that loss to a credit by multiplying by the tax rate of 25%. So he would have a $2.5 billion credit that he can sell immediately. In addition, there's a 20% credit itself on the $10 million. So under the Senate CS, he could actually get $4.5 million of credits he can sell day one. So he gets to monetize it early on, which a net present value basis is incredibly valuable. Plus, instead of walking away with the state sharing none of his risk, the state is sharing 45% of his dry hole risk. So I guess I'll get off the soapbox there, but the PPT is a fabulous mechanism for sharing dry hole risk. And I believe, I don't know how much, but I believe it will encourage a degree of new exploration.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. And maybe that was me taking advantage of your expertise to ask you to kind of comment on policy, but I really appreciate that. So if we pass the PPT in any of its existing forms, we don't have to go back and undo what we did before. Is that correct?
Well, there are some existing exploration incentive programs in place now, and I believe the way the bill is structured, you have a choice of using the credits for those programs or the credits under the PPT. As I understand the credits, and I'm not an expert on it, but I believe the way they work is, depending on how far away from existing wells they are, if they're drilling completely new prospects, you get a 40% credit. And if that were the case, one would choose one of the credits under one of those programs rather than the PPT credit. But you can't use both. You can do one or the other. But we would not have to undo what we did before.
Senator Dyson, follow up?
Yeah, thank you. This is really valuable. And does the producer get to make that election, or does the state make that decision? The producer gets to make it, doesn't he?
That's correct.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could just add one thing to that. Senator Dyson, I think one of the criticisms of what's happening in Cook Inlet, as Roger said, is under 185, in fact, dry holes did qualify. But you had to meet these other sort of wildcat type criteria. So, for example, so far under SB 185, while about $33 million has been issued in total of credits under that program, less than $2 million of that was in Cook Inlet because of these distance requirements. So, and the one other point I want to make, and as you think about it, what will happen is, there are lots of restrictions in SB 185. It was a step, but we put lots and lots of caveats in there. So, in fact, the audits have removed a fair number of costs. What I think will happen is someone will apply for the 40%. Any cost or many of the costs that will get disallowed under the SB 85 rules will simply move over and receive the credit at 20% under the PPT rules. So you'd apply under one program. If we disallow a cost, like, for example, because you were splitting costs between two wells and only one of them qualified, what we disallow would be allowed at 20%. So the producer will probably apply the most aggressive, and then a lot of them will fall back to the other program.
Yeah, thank you. Let's see, I'm going to show my ignorance here, Roger, but under both, under the governor's bill, all development and exploration costs, even within, say, the Prudhoe Bay unit, that but get allowed a credit. Is there anything we are doing here in the Senate CS that disallows any of those credits within existing fields? I'm thinking about fields that are shallow or deeper or anything. Is there anything that we are doing here in this CS that removes the credits that were allowed under the governor's bill?
Well, I'll let Dan correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe insofar as the treatment of credits and deductions for capital expenditures, I believe the governor's bill and the Senate CS are identical.
Yeah, that's my understanding, and he is nodding. Thank you.
Did you want to comment, Dan?
There are some minor exceptions having to do with abandonment costs, but aside from that, sorry.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman.
And thank you, Madam Chair. How are the Bristol Bay areas treated?
They would receive the same
treatment. As Coquitlam?
Correct. They're in the, neither the governor's bill or the CS are there any geographical restrictions or limitations except for private royalty holdings. That's the only place where those appear. In the CS, there are none within the governor's bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Continue.
Okay, we're back on slide 32. This is all the Cook Inlet gas fields and what their ELFs are. And the weighted average ELF in Cook Inlet is just about exactly 0.5, which suggests the average well productivity is about 6,000 MCF a day. And of that 6,000, they're getting 3,000 tax-free. If you go over to slide 33, again, the ELF is based on 1977 economics. Without talking about all the calculations here, I mean, the bottom line is if you're getting a Henry Hub price for your gas in Cook Inlet through the ELF, you're probably recovering seven times more than you should, given what the ELF is supposed to be doing. Mainly, again, is how much gas you need at the market price to cover your operating costs. Now, when we say, you know, when we talk about sort of the function or dysfunction of the gas ELF in Cook Inlet, its function on the North Slope is vastly different. The North Slope, you know, if there's a gas line with the you know, high upstream costs and the very, very high downstream costs, the function of the current ELF there is a completely different story. But we're mainly focusing on how it functions in Cook Inlet now. So finally, slide 34, what can we say about Cook Inlet gas as a result of PPT? Now, we did not include the effect on Cook Inlet gas in the physical note because its effects would have been relatively small, and again, it highly uncertain. But if we just look at a snapshot at the present, and without getting into any taxpayer-specific information, we estimate the crossover point at about $3 per MCF on existing fields. Under the governor's bill, with the $73 million allowance, that crossover point would actually be about $2 higher. But as we explained yesterday, at 5,000 barrels a day or its equivalent, As you get higher production, the percentage of tax-free production you get goes down. So given a crossover point at $3, at $4 an MCF, just $1 higher, it'd be an increase of about $35 million annually on existing fields, and that's out of about $1 billion total in gross revenues annually. And as Cook Inlet gas production goes down, which it appears it will do, the amount of additional tax from the PPT will go down as well. A new production, insofar as there is an investment and they can deduct the investments and claim the credits, would see their taxes go down, new production. So that conclude our presentation on Cook Inlet and the fiscal impact as well.
Thank you very much. There's a question from Senator Dyson, please.
Actually not, Madam Chair. Just a comment. This entire presentation here was very valuable to me, and I appreciate it.
We know we'll continue to have that level of presentation. We'll take a five-minute break, and we'll conclude. We'll come back and hear Rob Mintz. And we'll begin with the navigating 305. Rob Mintz and Dan Dickinson. Are you going to begin today, Dan, or is it Rob?
Madam Chair, I hope Rob Mintz is on the phone. I basically am going to be assigned to answering questions and slide duty here. I think he's the one who would like to walk you through this.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I could, before
Senator
we get
Stedman.
Rolling into serious matters, I'm just curious on the, you know, it's easy to get lost and the sea of changes, and I assume that this is differential GPS navigation system so we can be on track with all these changes?
Yes, it is. It was at my request.
Okay.
Yes.
Here we go.
It's not enough that I don't understand one bill. I want to not understand two different versions and struggle through and then by the end to have a good grasp of everything that we're learning.
And we're on C? Or just in general?
C. What,
okay.
We're on C.
And Madam Chair, I hope, and as we go to the second slide, you'll see we, in fact, have color-coded everything so that as we go through it, we'll see what's there. But is Rob online?
Yeah. Yes, he is.
Yes, this is Rob.
Welcome.
Shall I proceed?
Yes, please do.
Yes, I'm Rob Mintz. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. And I'll be going through a presentation which is going to hit the core elements of the new production tax provision. Let me make a couple of preliminary comments. First, this does not purport to touch every provision of the bill, notwithstanding that it's 54. There are a number of provisions that kind of fix other problems or make other improvements in the production tax statute, but are not really core to the new so-called PPT approach. And we won't be dealing with those in this presentation. Second, there are two parts to the presentation. The first is kind of exploring the logical structure of the bill and how you get from logically from one provision to another, how they interconnect. And then the second part, which probably will be quite a bit shorter, is a flow chart, which goes through how you actually make the tax calculation. In a lot of the content of the slides is verbatim excerpts from the bill language, not all of it is, and text that's highlighted in red is there to just highlight particularly material or significant concepts, and text that's highlighted in green represents changes that the CS makes from the original governor's bill. So if we could turn to slide 2, the first change is that under the governor's bill, the new production tax provisions would take effect starting July 1, 2006. The CS would take effect starting April 1st, 2006.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
And on that date change, how much is that at $60?
Madam Chairman, Senator Hoffman, I would have to defer to others there to answer that.
Okay, maybe we can get that at a later date.
Senator Hoffman, I will get it for you in a moment or so, but let Mr. Miskin proceed, and I will get that number to you.
Go ahead, Rob.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Slide 3, this is the most fundamental core provision of the production tax statute. And under the governor's bill, this is the tax that is levied for all oil and gas produced each month. So just like the existing production tax, it remains a monthly tax. Unlike the existing production tax, which has a separate tax rate for oil and for gas, the bill would treat oil and gas the same. And the tax is a 20% rate applied to a new concept called net value of oil and gas, and it refers to a new section of the production tax statute, AS 4255-160. We turn to slide 4. A couple of changes that the CF makes. Of course, one of them is increasing the tax rate from 20% to 25%. Also, there's a change in terminology. What's called net value under the original bill is now called production tax value. And then there's a concept which actually only applies to a very tiny proportion of oil and gas produced in the state, and it kind of takes more time to explain than possibly is even worth. But this has to do with the tax treatment of the royalty interest of lessors under private oil and gas leases. And examples would be oil and gas leases issued by regional native corporations like ASRC and SERI. And because the new tax applies to oil and gas throughout the state, there really isn't a defined tax on a particular lease. The governor's bill dealt with this by adopting a kind of an allocation formula, but the CS deals with it in a different way, and that's carving out that royalty interest and having a separate tax on it. And that's shown on slide 5. And in the case of a private owner that has leased the land for oil and gas, that share of the oil and gas that goes to the owner as a royalty is taxed at a rate of 5% of the gross value at the point of production. Now, this is for existing leases, and this is the general rule, but as shown on slide 6, there is an exception for existing leases in the Cook Inlet Basin. The tax rate is 1.5% of the gross value at the point of production. I should emphasize that even though this is a tax on the royalty share, it's still a tax that's levied on the producer, and the producer is liable to pay. This just continues the existing rule that's always been the case for Alaska's production tax statute. Slide 7 provides that for future private leases, the commissioner shall recommend a tax rate to the legislature. I think this means that there actually is not there would not be an effective tax under the CS on private royalty shares until the legislature acts in the future. Now, if we turn to slide 8, this is the third element of the production tax under the CS, and it's been referred to, I think, as a progressive or progressivity tax, and it's on oil only. And I think it's been explained by previous witnesses, but basically, when the West Coast price of ANF gets to about $40 a barrel, there's an extra tax on oil, which is related, and the rate is related to the actual price of ANF.
Rob, Senator Stedman has a question.
I think I just want to make sure we come back at some time and we revisit that process of the legislature acting on setting a royalty rate or setting a tax rate.
From slide 7?
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
No, we don't just forget about it.
Okay. We'll make note. Yep. Senator Bundy.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, this, if I understand correctly, this applies to private leases only, but it does nibble at the edges of the question of certainty.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. And so, yeah, some further discussion.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, if I might make one other observation on that, the actual language that it talks about is leases in effect on the date. And if you have the bill in the CS in front of you, it's on page 4. find it here a second. Apologize. Sorry, it's on page 3, line 26, and it says the rate of tax levy on oil and gas produced from a lease in the state that is in effect on the effective date of this subsection. And again, people might want to think about, does that mean that if a lease were simply renegotiated, it would have no tax applied to it? So, you know, what constitutes a lease being in effect? In other words, the division was to be made between current leases and future leases. And the language that was used is this phrase, a lease in effect. So if a lease simply were to no longer be in effect because it had been renegotiated and replaced by another lease, would that mean that no tax could be asserted on that lease? That would be another question that we look at that review and hope you would consider it. In terms of administration, that's important to us.
Thank you. Go ahead, Rob.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. If we turn to slide 9, this just summarizes the fundamental provisions levying the tax. Under the governor's bill, there's a single production tax rate, 20% of net value, and the committee substitute has three components of a production tax, 25% of net value, except for the lessor royalty share, then coming back and dealing with the lessor royalty share at 5 or 1.5% of gross value, and then this additional progressive rate tax on oil only, which would apply to all taxable oil production, including the lessor royalty share. Turning to slide 10, now section 011, which levies the tax, refers to a 25% rate or 20% under the governor's bill of something called the net value of oil and gas, and that's explained in section 160. And it starts with a concept called the gross value at the point of production of oil and gas. This is a concept that has been in the production tax statute for many years, and this is not something that the bill changes. So we're not trying to fix something that ain't broke here. We're starting with the gross value, and then we're subtracting from that certain deductions. And the deductions are called lease expenditures in the bill. And these are lease expenditures that are adjusted in ways that I'll talk about in a minute. Now, under the governor's bill, there's another deduction which has to do with transitional investment expenditures, and that's been referred to sometimes as the clawback or the look-back provision. Let's look at slide 11 and see what's changed in the CS. As I mentioned before, what used to be called net values is now called production tax value. That's just a change in terminology. We still start with the gross value at the point of production, and we deduct lease expenditures as adjusted. There's no longer a deduction for transitional investment expenditures. However, a later provision of the bill has a substitute approach to dealing with that. So if we start with gross value at the point of production, what is that? Slide 12 refers to definitions in the bill. Now, the definitions in the bill are somewhat changed from the current definitions in the production tax statute. However, for oil, we don't believe it's a material change. It's just simplification and some update of the language. And the concept is that when the oil is in pipeline quality, the point of production is where it's metered. For gas, there is a substantive change in the point of production, and it has to do with an activity called gas processing. And gas processing usually involves refrigerating a gas stream to remove valuable hydrocarbon liquids, which are usually known as NGLs, or natural gas liquids. And under the current statute, gas processing is downstream of the point of production. For policy reasons that Dan or Robin may have a chance to get into or may already have discussed, the bill would move the point of production downstream of gas processing to allow gas processing costs to be deductible. But the basic concept, again, is where the gas is metered after the separation and processing has been completed. That's the point of production. Now, the slide 13, this is also unchanged from current law, and it just sets out the basic principle called the netback method of calculating value, and it just tells you that typically, of course, ANS produced on the North Slope is not sold up there. It's typically sold on the West Coast. And so we start with the destination value and subtract the cost of getting the oil from the North Slope to the destination. And that gets you to the gross value at the point of production. Now, there is one change, which is summarized on page 14, in how this gross value concept is addressed. The bill basically allows for some simplified formulas to be used where the Department of Revenue decides that it's appropriate. And under the governor's bill, the department could allow a producer to use the royalty value under a royalty settlement agreement with DNR, or it could develop other formulas using either DNR or, in the case of federal leases, U.S. Department of Interior royalty values, or it could develop other simplified formulas that, for example, use transportation costs, price indices, and so forth. And this is a permissive authority that the department would be able to use for efficiency and purposes, but still with the aim of getting a reasonable estimate of gross value. Now, slide 15 shows a change that the CS made in this provision. The green text shows that it now makes explicit that in order to allow a producer to use one of these simplified formulas, the department has to do a detailed fiscal analysis and make a determination that it's in the long-term fiscal interest of the state. And this also deletes one of the options in the governor's bill, which refers to using a royalty settlement agreement. Now, if we turn to page 16, to remind ourselves, we're dealing with how you calculate net value or production tax value. We started with gross value, and then we can deduct certain lease expenditures. Now, what are lease expenditures? Well, they're the total costs upstream of the point of production that are direct, ordinary, and necessary costs of exploring for, developing, or producing oil or gas. Now, that's a very general statement, and later provisions of the bill give more specificity to that. But for now, let's just see how the CS changed that on slide 17. Really, the only change in the fundamental definition of lease expenditures is that because of the different effective date, they are would be costs that are incurred starting April 1st rather than July 1st. Slide 18 deals with the very meaningful statutory guidance that the bill would give the department in determining what these lease expenditures are. And there are two types of sources of guidance that the bill directs the department to use. One is typical industry practices and standards as to what costs are allowed to be billed by an operator to other producers under unit operating agreements or other similar joint operating agreements. There's a lot of experience with with this kind of thing, and so it would direct the department to draw on that experience. And then the second source of guidance that already exists is the Department of Natural Resources standards for what costs are deductible under their net profit share lease regulations. The committee substitute makes one change in this, the basic definition, and that's shown on slide 19. The phrase direct ordinary necessary includes ordinary and necessary, which under the governor's bill would implicitly probably incorporate IRS precedent, but the CS makes that explicit, that ordinary and necessary has the same meaning that those terms have for federal income tax purposes, because that's an area that has long used those concepts. Slide 20 deals with some of the specific points that the bill addresses in terms of what costs are deductible and what are not deductible. And subsection D of 160 provides examples of costs that are deductible and also examples of costs that are not deductible. And I won't go, in the interest of time, I won't go into a lot of detail here, but there are some improvements that the committee substitute has that were recommended by the administration that improves the clarity of the bill. Slide 21, there are some additional exclusions that the committee substitute has. It excludes from deductible costs costs of dismantlement, restoration, removal, and so forth. In other words, end-of-life costs for a field to the extent that they would be attributable to oil and gas production that occurred before the new tax regime went into effect. There's also a limitation to make sure that costs above fair market value would be excluded when there are non-arm's length transactions. And also, it makes clear that if a producer buys another company, that those are not supposed to be deductible costs.
Okay, Mr. Mintz, Senator Stedman has a question, please.
Yeah, Madam Chair, one of the things that, as we work through this, we have these costs that are included and excluded. And I was wondering if we can get some comments on inclusion of, or exclusion when we start looking at business overhead. If we're looking at buildings or offices in or out of the state and what impacts these may have and how far reaching does this go?
Okay.
Madam Chairman, Senator Stedman, the bill actually addresses overhead very explicitly. And on in section subsection D1 of section 160, and that's at the top of page 17, actually 17 lines 7 through 10. Because I believe overhead would generally be considered an indirect cost, and the general rule in the bill is that only direct costs are deductible. That's why the bill makes clear that it will allow as a reasonable allowance for overhead expenses, that's up to the department to determine by regulation. And the allowance is for overhead expenses directly related to exploring for developing, producing oil and gas deposits in the state. I know the question's come up in the past, what about a building, an anchorage, or some other facility? And I think the general answer is that just because a producer incurs costs in running its business does not necessarily mean those costs are deductible. They still have to be incurred directly for oil and gas exploration, development, or production. Dan or Robin may have additional comments.
Dan?
Madam Chair, I think that does sum it up. One of the points to go back to, when we look at industry practice, for example, what you will see, for example, in Prudhoe Bay Unit is BP is the operator. And so if a BP engineer is working on something for Prudhoe Bay, their salary might be billed to the other working interest owners, and then there'll be an overhead component. So BP's building, per se, never shows up in the building, but they'll say every time you use a person, there's an overhead component that will deal with the additional costs from having that person present. So I think that's the general approach that we would hope to take, and that this bill would authorize the commissioner to come up with an allowance for overhead as opposed to trying to allow certain categories of costs in as overhead.
Is there a standard calculation procedure in place now for various operators around the state?
Madam Chair, there is not a standard. There are standards, different ones. I think, as anyone knows who's in business, this is the classic negotiation about how overhead gets passed through on projects. And
okay. Thank you. Well, we will address that further.
Okay.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Mintz.
Thank you. Well, turning to slide 22, back in subsection A of section 6, it referred to deducting lease expenditures as adjusted, and subsection E talks about adjustments. The concept here is very simple, that it's a concept of allowing net costs to be deducted. So for example, if a producer gets reimbursed for some of the costs, those reimbursements should be netted against the cost that are deductible. If a producer acquires some asset by incurring costs that are deductible and then sells the asset, the sale receipts should also be netted out against the cost. And so that's what these are about. A couple of changes were added by the CS, as shown on page 23. The original bill said that if a producer gets paid by someone else for using a production facility, that payment should be an adjustment. And what the CS adds is, if a producer gets paid for managing a production facility, that management fee should also be deducted. And it also kind of closes a little bit of a loophole. I mentioned that where an asset is sold, the sale receipt should be netted out against the cost. If an asset is removed from the state and used elsewhere, that may not be sold, but it really should have the same effect, and so the removal from the state is treated as if it's a sale for purposes of the adjustments. Now, page 24 summarizes the intent of several groups of text. There are three places in AS 4355-160 that are probably kind of opaque if you read them by themselves, and this is just to explain what this is all about. As I mentioned, the adjustment to lease expenditures is intended to implement the rule of allowing only net costs to be deducted. The thing is that there could be some timing mismatches that could make that difficult, and these particular provisions that are summarized on slide 24 are meant to deal with the timing mismatches. Let me give an example. A few minutes ago, Roger Marks talked about an explorer who might incur $10 million for, say, drilling a well or wells. And the explorer doesn't produce any oil or gas, so there's no production tax to take credits against. But the $10 million, for example, those are deductible lease expenditures and can be converted into a credit at 25% under the bill. Well, if, for example, an asset that was purchased as part of that $10 million cost were sold by the explorer, that ought to be netted out against the $10 million. But if that sale doesn't take place until, for example, the next calendar year, and the explorer's already got the credit, how do you make that adjustment? And what these provisions say is, if a sale occurs, or if an adjustment occurs in a time period where a producer, an explorer, doesn't have any taxable oil and gas production, or if the lease expenditures are too low to deduct the adjustment from without getting to a negative number, you just go ahead and use that negative number, and it will generate a tax liability that offsets the adjustment and recognizes the adjustment, even though that's occurring in a later time period. I hope that helped out a little clarity, but if it didn't, then I'll be happy to answer questions. But for the time being, if we can move on to slide 25, these are some additional provisions that the CS added to the governor's bill, and it basically has to do with the concept of fair market value, that when there are expenditures made, purchases, for example, that would be deductible, and it's not in the situation of an arm's length transaction, that a standard is supposed to be applied of basically the price that you'd see if there was a producer dealing at arm's length with an uncontrolled entity. And there's express provisions for the department to have the ability to follow IRS rules in this respect. Now, if we turn to slide 26, back in the subsection A of the governor's bill, one of the deductions was transitional investment expenditures, and those are basically capital investments that would be considered capital expenditures for purposes of the production tax bill if they occurred after the bill took effect, but it was they were actually incurred during the previous 5 years. And the CS deletes this provision and instead provides a tax credit for some of these same type of expenditures, which I deal with later. Slide 27 deals with another provision of the original bill that is not in the same form in the CS, and this is the $73 million allowance per producer that would, under the governor's bill, would eliminate production taxes for producers that had a net value of oil and gas of no more than $73 million. And there's a different provision in the CS, which is summarized on page 28. And in this case, the allowance depends on the total amount of oil and gas production in the state that a producer generates. Now, oil and gas are treated as equivalent to allow you to get a single figure, 6,000 cubic of gas equivalent to one barrel of oil. And the idea is that if a producer produces no more than 5,000 barrels a day of oil or gas equivalent, that you get 100% allowance against your taxable oil and gas production. And as the amount of production goes up, that percentage of allowance drops rapidly until it reaches zero. Now, I'd have to ask Dan or Robin to confirm this, but I was just doing a few numbers in my head a little while ago, and although the bill on page 20, the CS has the cutoff point of 55,000 barrels a day, I think that's probably an old number that needs to be updated to reflect a change in the formula. I think that should be 30,000 barrels.
Madam Chair, that is correct, although mathematically that number doesn't matter since the formula takes you below zero at that point. In fact, it should, for someone reading it, it should say 30,000, not 55,000.
That's the less than 55,000 barrels of oil equivalent?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
If I could, Madam Chair, just a brief explanation of why that was in there. The older formula that was
amended it, the resources committee had a different multiplier in there, had 0.1, if I remember correctly, 5,000 less 0.1 times, and that multiplier was changed to 0.2 to run that tax holiday to zero at 30,000 barrels versus 50,000 barrels.
Okay.
That's what.
Thank you. Mr. Mintz?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that was exactly right, what Senator Stedman said. Now, both the $73 million allowance and the new allowance based on oil and gas production are a per-producer allowance, if we turn to slide 29. And because of that, we have to be very concerned about loopholes or abuse of this allowance, because if what triggers the eligibility is being a producer, then one could easily imagine by spinning off or dividing up or generating a multiplicity of different producers that one could generate a multiplicity of allowances too. So there's an anti-splitting provision in both the original bill and the CS, and it requires a producer that wants to get an allowance to demonstrate to the department that that kind of gaming has not been going on, and the department has to qualify a producer for a calendar year in order to get the allowance. So we've been through...
Rob, just a minute. Senator Bundy has a question, please.
Thank you. I think I asked yesterday why a five-year window was chosen, not four, not six, and I think the answer I got was just, well, that was a policy call. Do you have any information as to why 5 years is the best time?
Madam Chair, Senator Bundy, I think the senator is referring to the 5 years for the transitional investment expenditure look back, and that that's different from the allowance here. We'll get to that under the credits. Now, if I'm misunderstanding, please correct me.
Well, and that was my previous question, but now again we have under 35. 43-55-106-H qualifications for allowance ability to qualify expires in 5 years, and I'm just wondering why that time window was chosen.
Given the effective date of the bill, it would work out to from 2006 to 2013 would probably work out to like 7 years.
Yeah, Madam Bundy. I'm afraid I can explain how the text works, but I'm not that competent to explain the policy rationale for these decisions. I'm sorry, maybe someone else could.
No, okay, thank you.
Madam Chairman, if I can continue now, turning to page 30. So we've been through the calculation of net value, now called production tax value, and you'll recall that under section 011, when you get that number, that's where you apply the tax rate of 25%. However, before you get to the actual tax liability, there's the possibility of applying tax credits to the amount that would otherwise be due. And both the administration bill and the CS, of course, recognize that the tax that's due is after credits. So let's turn to the question of what the credits are. And we start off on slide 21 with the...
31, Rob. Slide 31.
31. And this is the credit for capital expenditures. And it doesn't change between the original bill and the CS. It's 20% of what's called a qualified capital expenditure. Now, what's a qualified capital expenditure? That's addressed on page 32. And for the most part, it's similar in both bills. The fundamental idea is that, first of all, it has to start out being a lease expenditure. A lease expenditure is everything that's deductible for purposes of calculating taxable value of oil and gas. And so I want to emphasize it's a subset of that. I believe in an earlier question of Roger Marks, Senator Dyson was asking about credits availability for existing operations and mentioned that the credit, in his view, would be available for all exploration, development, and production costs, or at least that was the question. And just to clarify, it's only the subset of exploration, development, production costs that are capital-type expenditures that are eligible for the credit. So all lease expenditures are eligible for deduction, but a subset of those are also eligible for the 20% credit. And for the most part, those are expenditures that are treated as capitalized under federal income tax rules. In addition to that, the bills would allow exploration expenditures for geological and geophysical activities, typically seismic exploration, to qualify for the credit. Now, an important limitation is to avoid the problem of a churning of one producer buying an asset, getting a credit, then selling it to a second producer who gets a credit. The restriction is that you can only get a credit for the purchase of an asset if it has not previously been placed in service in the state or previously been acquired as a result of an expenditure that will qualify for the credit. Now, the CF does add another important exclusion, and that's on slide 23, that
33
allow a credit for reclamation, dismantlement, abandonment, restoration types of expenditures, and also there's this phrase for an extended period of disuse. I'm not actually sure what that means, but I think it has to do with kind of suspending operations or mothballing operations.
Mr. Mintz?
Yes.
Gary Wilkin. On slide 32?
Yes.
What does G and G exploration mean?
That's actually just an abbreviation for geological and geophysical exploration.
Okay. Thank you.
And as I say, the main subset of that is seismic exploration.
Thank you. Senator Stebbins.
And if we could, just a previous comment right before Senator Wilkin stepped in, you sounded like you were confused on the bill as far as how a section of it could be interpreted. Do we have a language issue here, or did I mishear you? Or?
Madam Chairman, Senator Stebbins, I think what I was referring to was the phrase extended period of disuse in the exclusion. That was quoted on slide 33. And it's on page 9, line 28 of the bill.
Senator Stebbins, Madam Chair, if I might, there are two ideas there, neither of which is very well defined. First of all, what does disuse mean? Our concern, of course, is there are things that are there for safety or health reasons that maybe don't get used, but, you know, I mean, if the world goes well, you never use your fire engine. So there are things up there, do auditors go in and say, well, you haven't used this for 2 years, therefore we're not going to allow it. The second thing is this notion of extended period. So extended period of disuse, as we looked at it, we're clearly going to need either more clarity from the drafters or there'll have to be extended regulations, because that seems to be an open to a lot of interpretation.
Madam Chair, if we're good.
Yes, sir.
Am I correct to assume as we go through this bill and there's areas like that you just mentioned where the administration's having some issues with interpretation or what have you, lack of understanding or whatever, that we'll get a list from the administration so because this is a very complicated bill, and the more eyes that look at it, the better, that we can work through those issues?
Absolutely.
Madam Chair, we will, and hopefully you'll give us the right to supplement that as we continue to read the bill as well.
Thank you. Okay. Are we ready for the next slide?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Yes, if we turn to slide 34, now we come to the second major category of credit, and this is basically just a different form of allowing losses to be carried forward. In a calendar year where a producer's lease expenditures exceed the gross value of the oil and gas, there would be they're not allowed to deduct those to get to a negative value, to get a negative tax. So they're allowed to carry them forward. And for, I think, administrative simplicity, they're converted to a credit. And because the tax rate under the administration bill is 20%, under the administration bill provides for a 20% credit of carried forward excess lease expenditures, and it's called a carried forward annual loss. And a couple of changes on slide 35 under the CS. Of course, because the tax rate is 25% under the CS, then the tax credit would be 25% as well. And the term net value is changed to production tax value. Now, I should point out, Roger Mark a little earlier was explaining that the relationship between the credits under 024 of the bill and the existing exploration incentive credits under Section 025, which was enacted by SB 185, and he said that the producer has to elect which one to use. Just to clarify, that's true for the qualified capital expenditure credit, that one can either take a credit under existing 025 or under the new bill. However, for a carried forward annual loss, since that's just a way of again, carrying forward deductions that could not otherwise be used, one does not have to make an election for that. That can be taken advantage of in any case.
Senator Bundy.
This, on slide 35, the tax credit of 25% that can be carried forward, this is different than the investment credit of the 20% in the 25-20 formula. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Bundy, yes, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
And it's important to note that these actually are additive. I think Roger's example showed that. If there's a lease expenditure which is carried forward, you get the 25% credit for that. And if it's also a qualified capital expenditure, you get the 20% credit on top of it.
At what point do we have to start giving them money back?
Well, actually, that is indirectly dealt with in the next slide.
Okay, thank you.
An important feature of realizing the incentive nature of the credits, particularly for explorers and producers that do not have a lot of current production, is for them to be able to monetize the credits that they can't use against their own taxes. And the way that's done under both the bill and the CS is to allow for credits to be turned into transferable tax credit certificates, and that's done through applying to the department. And it's kind of an expedited process so that all of these aspects of the tax credit certificate provisions are meant to ensure that the value of the credit is not impaired. And therefore, once a certificate is issued, a producer that buys it and then uses it to reduce its own taxes can absolutely rely on that certificate for its face value. Now, if it should turn out that pursuant to an audit or otherwise, if the department later finds out that the original producer or explorer that got the certificate, that there was something amiss and that the amount of the credit was excessive or the credit wasn't justified, the department can back against that original producer explorer and assess the tax efficiency, but it would not impair the value of the certificate to the person that bought it.
Madam Chair.
Now, there's also on using the credit once it's purchased through a certificate, and that's basically to just prevent excessive impacts on total state revenue. When you purchase a certificate, you cannot reduce your tax liability in any calendar year by more than 20% below what it otherwise would have been. When you use your own credits, there's no limitation like that.
Senator Hoffman had a question, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This certificate is only available to be transferred to producers or explorers?
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, there's no express limitation on who can buy it. However, the only people who could ultimately benefit would be people that have a production tax liability, and now those would be producers. I suppose it's possible to imagine there could be intermediaries who would conduct a trade in them. I think that's right. If I'm wrong, I'll ask Robin and Dan to correct me.
Dan?
Madam Chair, no, that is correct. The restriction is only you need a production tax liability before it can be of any use. You cannot apply this against an income tax or a royalty obligation.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Dickinson or Mr. Mintz, just so I understand, these certificates are transferable amongst the three producers?
Senator Olson, through the chair, amongst all producers. In fact, what we'd expect is that these would generally be generated by explorers who would then sell them to the producers who have the income tax liability. Whereas if I'm an explorer, maybe 2 or 3 years, I'll finally get production and I'll be paying a production tax. But the ability is to monetize these immediately by selling to someone who can use them.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Continue.
Thank you. Okay, now we turn to slide 37. This is a new provision of the CS, a third credit, and it substitutes for the deductible for the deduction provision of the governor's bill for the transitional investment expenditures. Again, the transitional investment expenditures are what would be qualified capital expenditures if they were taking place in the future, but they're expenditures that were incurred in the previous 5 years. Now, how does the new credit work? On slide 38, it's tied to new investment, and so a credit for previous investments can only be taken in a time period when the producer makes new capital investments, and the amount of the credit that can be taken in any one period is limited to one half of the amount of the new capital investment, and that's why it's sometimes referred to as a two-for-one provision. Now, unlike the first two credits I mentioned, these transitional investment expenditure credits are not transferable, and they the provision also expires in 7 years, April 1st, 2013.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stedman.
I think we need to look at some of this language, line 26 through 28. Just seems a little on page 10.
10?
Yes.
Page 10.
That's the section of the bill that we're talking about. And line 26, it's number 4, notwithstanding D to F. Of this section, a producer may not transfer a tax credit to obtain a transferable tax credit certificate for a transitional investment expenditure. I guess if you transfer one, it's transferable, and if you can't transfer it, it's non-transferable. It just seems to be odd language, and I think we should look at that, and then maybe we should also look at some way of defining these different tax credits in some kind of a summary page or something to make it easier for people to follow as we work with different types of credits.
Is it already defined in statute?
A transferable?
All of these things.
Madam Chair, no, I do not believe any of the credits are. Some of the words associated with them are in 185, but each of these is a new credit defined. It is defined elsewhere in this statute, but it didn't. Sorry, in this bill, it does not already exist in statute.
Okay, they are. It is defined in this bill.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
And but then you want what?
Well, the question is how we want to handle it. I guess for the bill, Madam Chairman, is a complex bill with a lot of moving parts. And as we get further into the process and start getting into the debate side of it, it might be nice if we had some kind of a summary sheet. So when we talk about a particular transition credit, everybody's on the same page exactly what we're talking about, because it doesn't take long in the heat of debate for eyes to start glossing over this bill.
Well, I had mentioned earlier that I was requesting a glossary of all the terms, and we could certainly. There are going to be lots of them to be included in this glossary, so thank you. Thanks for the suggestion, Senator Stedman. Go ahead, Mr. Mintz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, slide 39 deals with one last credit issue, and that has to do with the conservation surcharges that are currently in the production tax statute. These are either 2 or 3 cents a barrel surcharges. The original bill allowed a credit to be taken against the production tax for the surcharge payments, and the committee substitute eliminates that credit. And it also makes another change in the surcharges. It reduces one of them from 2 cents to 1 cent per barrel, and increases another from 3 cents to 5 cents per barrel.
Okay.
So if we turn to slide 40, well, we've been through the calculation of gross value, we looked at lease expenditures, adjustments, deducting the lease expenditures, getting the taxable value, and applying credits against the tax to get to what you actually owe. Now, how do you pay the tax? As I mentioned at the beginning, this remains a monthly tax, but because we're now looking at upstream costs, there's some longer-term aspects of those that often require adjustment through the course of a year. The administration bill handled this by giving a safe harbor of 90% that each month a producer would only be liable to pay 90% of what the actual tax turns out to be, and there'd be a true-up provision March 31st of the next calendar year, where the rest of the anything left over would have to be paid. This is handled differently in the CS, as shown on slide 41. In this case, there's a 95% safe harbor, and then the remaining portion would be due not the next calendar year, but the end of the next calendar quarter. So the CS takes a calendar quarter approach. Remember now, there are three components to the production tax under the CS. This 95% safe harbor provision applies to the principal tax, which is the 25% tax on production tax value. There was also that separate tax on the private royalty share, and this is due 100% each month, just as under current law, because it's based on the gross value of the point of production, which doesn't involve nearly as much in the way of information and calculation. As far as I could tell, the bill in its current form, the CS does not actually specify payment of the third component, the progressive rate tax, and that's something which would be easily fixable and of course should be fixed.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stedman.
I understand the concept of 95% of the tax due with catch-up provisions. The section 43-55-11-F, with 100% of the tax tax due each month. I think we need to touch bases on that to make sure that there isn't something we missed there as far as. You know, what if a person said 99% and what happens or what have you? And then the third issue on the slide, on the surtax or progressivity rate, we can, there's a few things we need to work on. We can add language and get some help from the administration as far as the language would be workable to make sure that that tax is collected and it doesn't run as an IOU in perpetuity.
Madam Chairman, so we have one last slide, 42, on this main part of the presentation. And this just goes back to the question of private royalty share of the tax. Again, it only affects a small amount of production, but it gets a little bit complicated. Now, it's always been the case that even though the whole production tax is a liability of the producer, including that part of the production tax on the royalty share, that the producer has the legal right to collect against the royalty owner for that royalty share of the tax. And the original bill provided a default formula for how you calculate that royalty share on the 20% tax. As I mentioned, as far as private lessors under private oil and gas leases are concerned, the CS, we don't have to worry about any kind of default formula because there's a separate tax on that. However, there are other types of royalty interest besides the royalty owned by a lessor under an oil and gas lease, and these are usually called overriding royalty interests. Mm-hmm. These would be typically carved out of the producer's or the lessee's share of the production. And those are usually invisible to the regulators, to the tax authorities, or to DNR. They're private transactions. But because the producer does have the right to collect that share of the tax against the overriding royalty owner, and because this 25% tax on net value doesn't actually define a particular tax for a particular lease, the bill does provide a default formula for doing that. If the royalty owner and the producer want to agree to something else, that's fine, and the bill recognizes that. It's just in the absence of an agreement, there's a formula provided which is slightly different than the one in the original bill. It's kind of complicated, and as I say, it doesn't affect that much in the way of production. So I don't plan to go into any details unless there are questions.
Any questions on slide 42? Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Thank you. So the last part of the presentation, which shouldn't take long at all, is a flow chart, which kind of summarizes how the system works, how the new tax regime works, and in terms of how a producer would calculate the production tax. Slide 44 shows that because the main tax is a statewide tax, a producer looks at all the properties in the state that he's producing from and calculates the total statewide gross value of the producer's taxable oil and gas. So that's the first number the producer gets. Now we come to the deduction part of it on slide 45, and that's lease expenditure. Again, these are statewide exploration, development, and production costs modified by those concepts of direct, ordinary, and necessary. And to get to the to implement the rule of net cost, you subtract the adjustments, which would be reimbursements, facility fees, sales of assets, and so forth, and that gets you your adjusted lease expenditures. Now, I explained before that if in the course of a calendar year, the lease expenditures are more than the gross value of your production, you get to carry forward the excess as a credit. Within a calendar year, however, you don't need to get a credit. You can, if you have an excess amount of lease expenditures in any month, you can just add that into your lease expenditures for another month. So that's what this box off to the side is all about. You take your adjusted lease expenditures for the month. If there are any unused expenditures from other months in that year, you can include those, and those are what you can deduct from your gross value of the oil and gas. Now, slide 46 then, the elements of your tax calculation. You start with that gross value, you subtract your adjusted lease expenditures. And then there's the possibility of that allowance if your statewide oil and gas production is no more than 30,000 barrels a month. If there's any taxable value after you adjust your lease expenditures, but that's why it says remainder greater than zero, and you qualify for an allowance based on your total amount of production, then you can subtract that allowance, and that gives you the production tax value of your oil and gas. Again, though, before paying the tax, you might have some credits that you can take advantage of. Page 47, these are the two types of the transferable credits. Your carry forward of excess lease expenditures, which would get a 25% credit because that's the tax rate, gives you your carry forward annual loss credit. And then that subset of your lease expenditures, which qualify as capital expenditures, also gets a 20% credit for qualified capital expenditures. Slide 48 just reminds us that those two types of credits can be transferred through the department's issuance of tax credit certificates, which then may be sold to other producers who can perhaps better use them. Then slide 49 deals with this separate non-transferable credit for the look-back provision for capital investments during the previous 5 years. And if you have them, again, you can only deduct them in a month for which you're making current capital investments. And if you are making current capital investments, you can get a credit for your past investments up to one half of your current capital investments. That's the two-for-one approach. The credit is at the rate of 20%. So then we come to the total tax calculation on slide 50 under the principal production tax component. We started with that production tax value and apply a 25% tax rate, which gives us the tax before the credit. If the producer has his own credits, that can be deducted as much as he wants, down to, of course, a net tax of no less than zero. If the producer has purchased credit certificates from someone else, they can only be used in a calendar year to the extent of reducing the tax by no more than 20%. And then the remainder is what you have to pay. Now recall we have two other components of the production tax under the CF, and slide 51 shows the production tax on the private lessor royalty share, which is the gross value at the point of production for that royalty, that lease, and it's multiplied by either a 1.5% or a 5% tax rate, 1.5% for Cook Inlet, 5% elsewhere. And that gives you the amount of tax paid on the royalty share. Again, even though it's on the royalty share, it's owed by the producer. And then finally, we have the progressive tax rate when oil is above $40 for ANF. That's on slide 52. You look at your statewide oil production, and then there's there's an arithmetic formula that's set out in the statute for calculating the tax rate based on the value of ANS, and the higher the value of ANS, the higher the tax rate. And that gives you the amount of tax payable for the third. And then on page 53, we have the actual payment requirement. Different for the 25% principal tax, which is what's shown on 53. When you've calculated your tax is payable, 95% is owed, and it's paid at the end of the next month after production This is exactly the same procedure that we have under current production tax law. In other words, for oil and gas produced during March, the tax return and the tax payment are due at the end of April. But then, if there's anything left over, that's due the end of the calendar quarter following the current calendar quarter. And that would be true for, of course, any tax left over for January, February, or March following the current calendar quarter. Well, actually, the one that ended yesterday. And then finally, the progressive tax rate on oil. Tax on the private royalty share. Whatever is calculated as owed for 1 month, 100% of that is due at the end of the next month, just like with the current production tax. And that takes me to the end of the slideshow. I'd be happy to answer any further questions.
Senator Sidman.
Yes, Madam Chair, you know, one of the things we need to put back on is the implementation of our little cake we're cooking up here, throwing in all the ingredients. I was wondering if we can get some feedback from our presenters today on how difficult or simple they feel that this is going to be to implement, and to, I guess, both initially and then ongoing, mm-hmm. as far as everything from gaming to differences of interpretation.
Yeah, what's necessary to implement and actually carry it through. Do you want to comment on that, Dan? Or
Madam Chair, I would like to. And I think some of that was in the fiscal note. I believe that the main issue is one that is not different between the governor's bill and the CS, and that is taking the area of upstream costs, which currently do not form a part of either royalty or tax or severance taxes, and therefore it's an area that we have not audited and are not familiar with. I think bringing those to a point where our auditors are comfortable with what they're doing and what they're seeing will be the biggest challenge. There will be disputes. If I might observe, in the current production tax, downstream costs are audited. Those are roughly $1.5 billion. There are 11 words in the statute. It says the actual cost of transportation of that oil or gas. Mm-hmm. We have hundreds of pages of regulations interpreting those 11 words that have developed over the last 3 decades. What we tried to do in this statute was strike a balance. We gave a lot more direction to the department. We didn't just say the actual cost of developing, exploring for, and you know. So there's a lot more fleshed out here. Still, a lot is left for regulation, a lot is left to the fact that this bill will stand for, you know, however many years, and we'll have to interpret it through regulations. So we've tried to give more guidance than in the past. We've left it open. There will be disputes. There's no question about that. We hope we've identified the areas and tried to define them well early on. But clearly, That to me is the major challenge. There are three new positions in the fiscal note. When you put together unfilled positions at the moment, I think that would be 6 new auditors focusing on that area. There is money for contracts that currently spend their time representing small royalty owners, say in Texas or in Oklahoma, and audit costs small working interest owners. We hope to get those kinds of entities involved, both to help us do the initial rounds of audits and help us build capacity, how we train people, how we write manuals, those kinds of things. It is not a small undertaking, but I think it's an important one, and it really is necessary if we're trying to focus on, again, get back to that first slide I showed, but to focus on encouraging investment and yet, you know, allowing it all to be deductible. We're making a quantum shift here, but we also need to be confident that what we're seeing is what's going on, and we're getting the investment and allowing the appropriate deduction.
Yeah. Senator Stedman.
If I could, Madam Chair, I think another item that might be helpful, especially with people that are home that will try to follow us the next few weeks, is if we had a little slide showing the difference on the upstream and the downstream.
where point of production is, that type of stuff. Because these terms are going to be thrown around the table here like their old hat. And
in fact, I had just talked to my staff this morning saying it'd be nice to have a pictorial that envision and explains upstream, downstream. And it's hard to, to me, it's backward. It seems like the cost would be just the opposite. So,
Madam Chair, I apologize that there was, in fact, when this was in five separate presentations, there was an upstream, downstream set of things, and we can certainly distribute that. And maybe if you had questions, come and talk to you about that.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions for either Dan Dickinson or Rob Mintz? Thank you to all of you.
I do have one question, Madam Chairman. As we look at the financial, the fiscal note that's on there, it was noted yesterday that there was going to only be three tax auditors and one technician. As complicated as the bill is, are you still standing by just those four people that are going to be needed for the implementation? And just as a follow-up to Senator Stedman's question.
Senator Olson, through the chair, that's three new. In other words, I believe that's on top of the current production tax auditors. Off the top of my head, I think that's nine already. So, and part of this is based on the notion that we can do some sharing of responsibilities. In other words, right now, we spend a lot of time auditing the exact same things the Department of Natural Resource auditors audit. If, in fact, we ultimately conclude, for example, this the CSS will do a study. If we conclude we shouldn't do that, we'll probably come back with a fiscal note that says, we need more auditors. But it's our belief that if by a combination of adding people and sharing some of the workload with the Department of Natural Resources, and I think as Robin explained yesterday, actually piggybacking on some of the audit work that Exxon does, looking at how BP spends its money in Prudhoe Bay, or BP looking over ConocoPhillips' shoulders in Kuparuk, we believe we can craft something that's effective.
And if it was the governor's proposal for the original 305, would that exclude these three new auditors?
Senator Olson, through to the chair, I believe on the personnel side, the fiscal note did not change between the governor's bill and this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Bundy.
We may want to put in an inflationary factor. From the looks of this, how long it takes to calculate the thing, money not anything anymore. I don't know.
Senator Wilkin.
Ma'am, I just want to echo Senator Dyson's comments. I thought the presentations today were really helpful, and I thank you for all the work.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all of you for being here today and sharing your Saturday to learn about this. And on Monday morning, we will gavel in at 9 a.m., and we will continue with the presentation from the administration. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. And for you and Senator Wilkin, as you think about next week, we have a scheduled only one Hess hearing, and that's on Wednesday. And if it's important to our process here, we can move that.
Okay.
But you know, we got a lot of work to do.
Yeah, it's going to be kind of a jam-packed 2 weeks, and so if we can all kind of keep our schedules a little more flexible, that would really help so we can get through all the proper hearings. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Not, we are adjourned.